to the Tome, Episode 4, Complete Maid. Hey guys, welcome back to another Tome. The Tome is a D&D game book review podcast focused on official D&D content. In this episode, I am reviewing Complete Mage. The next episode will be Dragon Magazine issue number 350, which might come out early given my upcoming break for Thanksgiving. After that, Expedition to Castle Ravenloft is next on my list, and in the future I also expect to look at Fiendish Codex 2, having already looked at Fiendish Codex 1. If you have any thoughts to share on any of these titles, I would love to include your opinions in the show. People might like to hear from more than just little old me. You can email the show at thetomeshow@gmail.com. You can leave a comment on the website at http://thetome.podbean.com, or you can be an early poster to the forum at http://thetome.freepowerboards.com. Speaking of which, I want to give a shout out to Pat Werda, who sent me feedback on every single episode since number one. Some of it even constructive. But in fairness, I already knew Pat before I started making the show. I also recently heard from another listener, Jason, and I'm going to mispronounce his last name, Jason Iacoangeli. That's as close as I'm going to get, I think. And I'm sorry about mispronouncing your last name, Jason. But I was pleased to read Jason's email. He says he's listened to all the shows. He shared an interest that he has in Eberron and Dragonlance. So I might want to do some looking at some more Eberron and Dragonlance material in the future. He also asked about maybe doing some novel reviews for Wizards of the Coast novels. And maybe as a quarterly special, maybe every 3 or 4 months I put out a special, which is something I might consider doing. I don't know. I don't know that I necessarily feel highly qualified to review novels, but I'm willing to give it a shot. Why not? Maybe I'll do it as a special episode in the future, and what I'll do is I'll probably review a series as I finish reading a whole series, a whole story arc of usually the trilogies. Currently, I'm reading Year of Rogue Dragons, that series, so maybe when I finish that up, I might think about, and I run into some free time, I might think about putting together a special episode reviewing that and see what you guys think about it. If you have any thoughts on that, let me know. If you guys want to send in reviews on novels, awesome. I'll totally include it in the show, put it on there, so maybe somebody a little more qualified than myself could jump on that. Chapter 1, Fundamentals. This, in all honesty, is the fluff chapter. There's not a ton of crunch to this one. It starts with a treatise on the origins of magic. Where it comes from, how it's used by people. It's presented as a collection of theory. And while it mentions divine magic, of course the focus is going to be on arcane magic. Which makes sense, since mage, as in complete mage, generally implies an arcanist. They also throw in some possible origins of the warlock from Complete Arcane. Next up is a section about the schools of magic, complete with overly lengthy description, tips on personality types that tend to choose a certain school of magic to specialize in case the reader happens to lack any creativity at all, but still wants to read about this, which seems to be probably a small group of people. And then it finishes off with suggestions on schools that they would choose for a prohibited school if they wanted to specialize in a certain school. Which is probably the most useful bit in this section, which isn't saying too much. After that, they move into Arcane Archetypes, which is just another Wizards of the Coast version of putting roles into their book. Which is something that they seem to be doing a lot lately, which is a not horrible bit of fluff. I don't hate this as a bit of fluff in my book. Although, honestly, I'd probably rather see it in Dragon. I don't know, maybe it's just me. I like to see Dragon be full of fluff. I like to see my books be full of crunch so that I can read for inspiration in Dragon and then pull out a book when I want to actually do something with a character. That's me. But in any case, I don't hate the idea of roles, and I did get some neat ideas from there. So some of the roles that they list are pretty typical of what you'd expect, and some are a little bit more unique. The roles are blaster, booster, controller, generalist, necromaster, sniper, spy, strategist, who specializes in changing the battlefield, summoner, and in my opinion, the most intriguing concept, the warrior. They give advice in what classes, prestige classes, feats, spells might be good or might be bad for each of these roles. The chapter finishes off with a short little bit on how an arcanist can fill in for other roles, such as a warrior, a healer, or an expert, if you need such a if you're missing such a thing in your party. Chapter 2, Character Options. This chapter is all about alternative class features and feats. The alternative class feature idea is from the Player's Handbook 2, which suggests taking out class features from one of the core classes but adding in new features to provide a little bit of a different flavor to the class. In this case, a flavor usually with an arcane bent. Ironically, most of the class feature or alternative class features that they offer in here are for non-arcanist classes. Divine casters get a little bit. One of interest was the Elemental Champion for druids, replacing animal companions with elementals of various size and power as the druid gains levels. The rest come off pretty typical of what you might expect. Rangers are become arcane hunters. There's spell reflection for some people, bonus hit points for sorcerers, and on and on and on. Sort of the typical sort of stuff you might expect, but done in a nice official way that you know is probably balanced because it's in an official D&D book. The feats section is all the more interesting, especially the heritage and reserve feats. Heritage feats help add some flavor to your PC, allowing you to tap into, in this case, fey or fiendish bloodlines, including special and spell-like abilities. Reserve feats is the idea that if you have a spell with a certain descriptor of a certain level prepared but not cast, you can use a related weaker power at will. Let me give you an example. Let's say you have an electricity spell for a third level electricity spell, like a lightning bolt, or higher. You can prepare a higher level electricity spell, and you prepare that spell, and as long as you have that spell prepared and you haven't cast it and it's still in your mind and ready to go, you can shoot small little bits of lightning for a few d6 of damage. Nothing huge, nothing nearly as good as the spell, but it's a way to get a little bit of power out of that in a way that doesn't run out so that you don't end up having to adventure, and then whenever the arcanist runs out of spells, okay, time to stop, everybody rest. And then we'll start again in the morning. It's a way to sort of keep the adventure moving a little bit. And of course, the higher level spell that you have prepared, the stronger the ability is. So if you prepare a fifth level electricity spell, then it's more powerful than if you prepared a third level electricity spell. You might get a little bit more boost out of that little jolt that you get. Since sorcerers don't prepare spells, it seems to me that this becomes a little bit extra awesome for them. Otherwise, there are some neat Wujin feats if you want to bring in Wujin from Complete Arcane, and for the spirits that come with Wujin. Otherwise, there's more generally pretty alright feats, nothing that really stands out as this is a feat you've got to have. Chapter 3, Prestige Classes. You might be surprised to learn that this chapter seems to be all about prestige classes. Let's do a quick run through. Abjurant Champion. A warrior who uses abjuration magic as a boost. Only 5 levels to this one, so it might be a way to pick up a few quick little abilities and then move on to something else. Eldritch Disciple, which is your warlock-divine caster combination, a bit like the Mystic Theurge. Eldritch Theurge. This is your warlock-arcane caster combination, very much like the Eldritch Disciple. Enlightened Spirit. This is a warlock who harnesses celestial power, sort of tossing away the fiendish connection they had when they became a warlock. Holy Scourge. Another 5-level little prestige class, so you can take it, get some neat abilities, and move on. And the idea is that you have an arcane caster with sort of a goodly sort of priest-like bent to him. Ridding the World of Evil gets bonuses to evocations against evil creatures and smiting and that kind of stuff. Lyric Thaumaturge. which is it's a bard prestige class who has a focus, it seems, on improving magical might. A bard who wants to get a little bit more magical oomph. Master specialist, gain more abilities in your specialized school without giving up too much in sacrifice. You get all your spell levels, plus you get special abilities at every level. Nightmare Spinner, which is an illusionist prestige class that focuses on causing lots of fear. Again, another nice little 5-level one if you want to create an illusionist and not give up a ton of levels and other things. This is a great way to pick up some neat new abilities. The Ultimate Magus, which is your wizard-sorcerer combination prestige class, which seems like it might be a little overpowered, although I've said the same thing about the Mystic Theurge in the DMG. So if the Mystic Theurge doesn't seem overpowered to you, this may not bother you. But they over the course of the entire prestige class, they only lose 3 levels of spellcasting total. Otherwise, most levels they gain both spellcasting in wizard and in sorcerer classes. Besides that, they also gain special abilities at pretty much every level. And so they seem to get a lot of advantages and not a lot of disadvantages for picking up this prestige class. The Unseen Seer, a rogue diviner sort of combination. The idea being that you can sneak around, maybe sneak right up to that door, but why risk disarming the trap on that door if there's nothing on the other side? The Unseen Seer is going to be able to find that out for you because they'll get up to that door, cast a little divination to see what's over there, and if it's not worth their time, move along. That's sort of the idea. And then lastly is the Wild Soul, which is an arcanist that seems to have some sort of connection with Fae of the Seelie or Unseelie court, depending on whether or not they are a good person or not so much. Chapter 4, Spells and Invocations. All right, spells. Here are some of the highlights. Adamantine Wings, Sorcerer, Wizard, and Wujin, level 7. Causes you to grow wings, adamantine wings, that you can use for flight, you can use them to attack, or you can launch the feathers in sort of a metallic feather cone of death. Arcane Fusion, Sorcerer, level 5. One of the few that are only for sorcerers, not for sorcerer and wizard. Basically, you get to cast a first level spell and a fourth level spell simultaneously by using up this fifth level spell slot. Caustic Mire, Sorcerer Wizard level 4. This one covers the floor in sort of this acidic slime. It slows people down, plus for every square they move through, it hurts them. If you stand still, it hurts you, and it lets off fumes that makes fire more potent. Coat of Arms, Sorcerer Wizard 5th level. Creates a blade of force for every 3 levels of the caster that spin around the caster. So because the blades are spinning around, it gives you a +1 to AC for each blade. And then you can sort of magic missile-like, you can shoot those blades off to attack somebody for 2d6 damage. So it creates some options and some utility. I like it when a spell gives you options. You can do this with it, you can do that with it, be creative and have fun. I like that. And they make it easy to do it by putting it right there in the rules. Adamantine Wings does the same thing, which is why I also included it on this list. Dreadful Form of the Eye Tyrant, a sorcerer wizard spell of 8th level. This is an example of one of the new polymorph subschool spells. They come up with this polymorph subschool for the transmutation school. And there's a whole bunch of these, and basically you cast them and they let you turn into a monster. In this case, a beholder. Gives you some temporary hit points, gives you some special abilities for that monster. A neat little idea to make the transmuter a little bit more utility for that transmuter and what their options are when they cast their transmutation spells. Familiar Refuge, Sorcerer Wizard level 6. Which is a spell that adds an interesting bit of usefulness to having a familiar. You can instantly teleport yourself to the familiar, or vice versa, transport the familiar to you. Although, honestly, it seems to me the most useful aspect is teleporting you to the familiar. Especially since it only has a verbal component. So, say your character is all tied up, you're trapped somewhere, you've been captured by the enemy, but your familiar can get away. Great, verbal component, say a word, boom. Yeah, you're with your familiar and everything's okay. Or maybe you send your familiar off to do some scouting for you, set yourself up for a strategic attack or an ambush or whatever. Familiar sneaks off, nobody bothers to check because it's just a rat running around a dungeon. No, what's the big deal about that? Pop, now you're over there, ambush time. Then there's a series of spells called Heart of Air, which is second level, Heart of Earth, fourth level, Fire, fifth level, and Water, third level. These are Druid, Sorcerer, Wizard, and Wujin spells. And the idea of the spell is that it converts part of the caster into whatever element it is. And you gain some magical abilities accordingly. Plus you get one one-time use ability that once you use it, expends or ends the duration of the spell. The cool part here, though, is that as you add on more of these spells, say you cast Air and Earth on yourself, you get some extra bonuses for having both spells. If you have all four spells cast on you, then you gain even more special abilities. And so basically, and they last for 1 hour per level, so they can last a long time, given how often, and especially a adventuring party with an Arcanist has to stop to rest, this could be an entire day as of adventuring. Cast each of these spells once, you've got a whole slew of special abilities, and you become a bit of a powerhouse. Very impressive. Then there's Lightning Leap, a sorcerer wizard spell, fifth level, where your body actually turns into the lightning bolt. So you sort of have the attack ability of a lightning bolt mixed with the movement ability of a dimension door in one spell. You turn into a lightning bolt, you zap through your enemies, and then at the end of the lightning bolt, poof, you appear. Magic Savant, bard, second level. This one gives you a +4 to use magic device checks, which might allow you to use an item that you may not have been able to use otherwise. But even more so, it also lets, in certain situations, it lets you take 10 using a magic device when normally you may not be allowed to. There's a whole bunch of neat little prismatic spells, so if you're interested in pulling out the old prismatic idea of different colors and different effects from one spell, that one's for you. And then there's a cool one called Seed of Undeath, which is would be great for a villain if you're a DM. Cleric, Sorcerer, Wizard, 4th level spell. It doesn't actually hurt anybody. It doesn't cause any damage. It just puts this little seed of negative energy in somebody, and it lasts for 1 day per level. And then what happens is whenever that person dies, they're instantly raised as a zombie. Under your control, even better. I could totally see an evil wizard, just every henchman they have, casting this spell on them, on a regular basis, 1 day a week or whatever it is, they're going to cast the spell on all their henchmen, so all their henchmen turn into zombies as soon as they die, so that even once the henchman has died, then you have the added challenge of, okay, great, we killed him, now they're back, we got to kill him again. I could have all kinds of fun with that. And then it has a whole list of invocations for warlocks, most of them tied to a lot of the new spells that are in here. So, Chapter 5, Arcane Items. Hey, guess what's in this chapter? Nope, not pot roast recipes. Here's the highlights. Spellguard rings. At only 4,000 gold pieces, I don't know why all adventurers aren't wearing these around, at least all adventuring parties that have spellcasters in them. Spellcaster wears one, an ally wears the other. Now the ally is immune to all the spellcaster's spells. You can fireball all day long, and the barbarian in the front lines is not going to be hurt by the sorcerer's fireballs. Awesome. Rod of Many Wands. You can place up to 3 wands in this rod, and then activate all 3 wands simultaneously as one action. The disadvantage being, the more wands you have in the rod, the more charges it takes off of it. There's a handful of new staffs. I usually don't spend a lot of time looking at staffs, generally because they tend to be only for higher level characters, which cuts out a lot of PCs out there. But there are some new staffs out there if that's your thing. There's the Cloak of Comfort, which is a cloak of resistance, really, but it adds the extra benefit of an Endure Elements spell for the wearer and all of his allies. So you can be comfortable wherever you're at, as well as protected. And then there's the Murderer's Gloves. A neat, neat little item. And I didn't talk about the spell that's associated with it, but there's an assassin spell that's associated with it earlier that you can look at if you get the book. But the idea is that after you make an attack, you turn invisible. And it's specifically a sneak attack, so or similar types of attacks. You make a sneak attack, the wearer instantly turns invisible, but only for one round. But if you keep it up over and over and over again, right, you can be turning invisible every single round, and then because you're invisible, you keep getting sneak attacks. Awesome combination. There's alchemical items, just sort of a random handful of stuff. Water breathing, creating alarms, lighting torches, creating new water, that kind of stuff. Nothing real impressive there, but there's a handful, not much. And then lastly, they have optional spell components, material components. If you want to spend a little bit of extra cash, take a little side quest, your spells might last a little longer or be a little more effective, stuff like that. Personally, I think it'd be neat to sort of toss these things in as a DM to fill out and round out the treasure that a player might pick up, but I probably would not, as a player, go out and seek this kind of thing out for my Arcanist. Chapter 6, Arcane Adventures. We start off with a whole list of of adventure hooks, and how do you turn a normal sort of adventure hook into an arcane adventure hook, and just a list of different ideas on how to give arcane flavor to an otherwise non-specialized adventure. And then it also has a long collection of magical locations, and that's what makes up most of the chapter, is all these magical locations, which is another thing that Wizards of the Coast seems to be doing a lot lately. I keep seeing more and more magical locations, whether it be in Forgotten Realms material or in just the non setting specific material like this. I see a lot of magical locations, sort of like I see a lot of roles popping up lately, which is kind of cool. I don't mind it right now. If they keep it up, I think it's going to get old, and it's going to get old fast. Because you read this a few times, and I think I figured out how I could put one together on my own. I don't necessarily need them coming out with a million different magical locations. But for now, it's kind of cool. Here's a summary of some of the locations. Bacob's Reading Room. By sitting in Bacob's chair, reading his book for 8 hours, a spellcaster can basically gets a free spell, a new free spell in their spell book, only usable once a year. Bigby's Tomb. By grabbing a hand on Bigby's Tomb, you gain the once a day ability to cast a Bigby's hand spell. You get a different spell depending on the level of the caster, so the more powerful the caster, the more powerful the spell they get. And it introduces a new spell, which kind of bothers me. The spell's cool, and it's a lower level spell, and it's designed, it seems, to be used to distract spellcasters from casting spells, and so it's kind of neat. But why is it located here? Why did they bother to put the stats for the spell in the middle of the Arcane Adventures chapter when they have a whole chapter dedicated to new spells? Why not throw it there and then reference it here? Would have made a ton more sense to me. Bad organization, bad editing. I'm not sure what happened here, but somebody dropped the ball. Then there's the Dragon's Blood Pool. Drink from a pool of dragon's blood to activate sort of your natural spell casting ability for a year. All in all, sorcerers gain one bonus spell slot between levels 1 and 3. It's sort of their answer to Bacob's Reading Room for sorcerers. There's the Boneyard, a place where a lot of dead people are, and so it's gained some sort of mystical energy. And it's a place where necromancers can gain the ability to make their spells a little more potent, a little more powerful. There's the Worldmeet Glade, a natural place where various worlds sort of bleed together, which is another place sort of like the Boneyard, only this time it makes conjuration spells a bit more potent. There's a whole, and that's just two examples. The Boneyard and the Worldmeet Glade are just two examples of a series of locations they have in here focused on improving spell casting for one specific school of magic. All in all, while this book had its faults, there were a lot of really cool ideas here. I'm particularly interested in building a mage to fill in the warrior role to see how that works, trying out some new feats, and taking a few new spells for a test drive. However, if you don't have Complete Arcane, you do lose significant value in this book, since a lot of material is for warlocks and Wujin from that book. They're honest about it right up front when they list Complete Arcane as a necessary book in the introduction. But really, who looks at an introduction before buying a book? I know I don't. I barely look at the introduction after I bought the book. All said and done, retail price for this book is $29.95. The value I would give it if you don't own Complete Arcane is $20, maybe even a little less. The value if you do have Complete Arcane, though, is closer to $25, so it's getting real close to the actual value of the book. Well, that's Complete Mage. If you have any thoughts to add, or you want to send in a guest review of upcoming material, such as Dragon Magazine Issue 350, Expedition to Castle Ravenloft, or Fiendish Codex 2, or if you have anything else that you might want to review that I haven't, and send along a guest review to that would be cool. Or if you have a suggestion for the show, you can do all that by emailing thetomeshow@gmail.com. That's one word, thetomeshow@gmail.com. Leave a comment on the website at http://thetome.podbean.com. Or be an early poster at the forum at http://thetome-podbean.com. www.freepowerboards.com. Lastly, I again want to thank Pat and Jason for all of their feedback. I also want to give a shout out to Sean from Raging Bullets, which is a DC Comics fan podcast, a podcast I listen to. And he's given me a little bit of feedback lately, and he helped inspire me to do this show to begin with. So I just wanted to give a quick shout out to them. And you can find Raging Bullets at www.ragingbullets.com. Thanks for listening. And if you like the show, please leave me a review at iTunes or send me some feedback at thetomeshow@gmail.com. Keep reading. That's been episode 4 of
The Tome.